This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
In her political thriller, Vox, author Christina Doucher used her work in linguistics to inform the imagined society in which a political regime silenced women with word counters. And not just grown women. Baby girls as young as 3 months were being fitted with these bracelet word counters on their small wrists. Each female was allotted 100 words a day. The counters reset at midnight, and each infraction was met with negative reinforcement, an electrical charge. And if you think a daily allotment of 100 words is a lot, here's some perspective. I've just used 96. I recently spoke with Christina Doucher about her work and her novel. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Your book, Vox, it's set in the not-so-distant future, a future in which women are silenced by limiting their speech to 100 words a day. You know, I was trying to figure out when exactly it was set, because you referred to a couple of our presidents. In your mind, when was this book set?
Sure. It's effectively set now, other than the speculative technology, the made-up technology, like, for instance, a cure for Wernicke's aphasia, which does not exist, and these word counters, which I think we probably have the technology to create those things. The book is effectively set in the present day.
And to set it up for our listeners, one of the main characters in the book is Jean. And when we meet her, she is at a dinner table with her family and her husband. And she has three sons, two of which are twins, and then a daughter. And they're having a dinner conversation, but it's really one-sided. I mean, how does this technology work?
Absolutely, it's one-sided. This is one of the nice things, well, the creepy things, nice and creepy are sometimes synonymous in my mind, about that first scene is that it's so absolutely normal, except for one thing. The husband's come home from work, the kids have come home from school, everybody's chatting about their day, except for the females. They're wearing bracelets. We're not supposed to call them bracelets. We're supposed to call them word counters in Vox. Bracelet sounds too sweet, I suppose, and decorative. They're wearing word counters on their wrists, which do exactly that. They mark the number of words that the females in this book can utter. And when the counter reaches 100, that's it. Now, there's no real control over the vocal folds. There's no physical silencing. The silencing comes through negative reinforcement of a sort of Skinnerian nature. If women go over 100 words, they get an electric shock that increases in intensity for every further amount of words that they say.
Jean and her daughter are both fitted with these counters. And Sonia is 6, is that right?
That's right.
At what age are girls fitted with these counters?
I think it was very early on, at 3 months or so, probably as soon as they start babbling. So as you can imagine, if you want to train someone not to speak, you want to start really darn quickly.
I just kept trying to think, well, do they factor in crying? I mean, how can you stop an infant from crying?
That's an excellent question. So I imagined that these word counters are doing exactly that. They're counting words. And so there's obviously some machine language capability built into them that would be able to differentiate between, let's say, a non-linguistic sound, like a snore or a grunt or a cry or a scream, and a linguistic sound, which would be a word. Actually, that's something that we very much have the technology to do. We can differentiate, or we can teach a computer to differentiate between linguistic sounds and non-linguistic sounds.
And there were some instances where Sonia had, you know, it was beyond her control. And that was one of the scariest scenes to me in the book, was when she was having a nightmare and she was hollering out. And I could just feel I could feel the terror when they were running down the hall just to try to stop her from screaming out in this nightmare.
And I felt it while I was writing it.
Oh, man.
I really did. Actually, that was one of the first scenes that I wrote. There were two scenes that I wrote out of sequence. One of them was the nightmare scene. The other one was the silent sex scene when Jean and her husband are in bed. But talking about the nightmare, I agree. I think it was absolutely terrifying, and terrifying on a few different levels. And on the one hand, we've got this little girl who's talking in her sleep. She's frightened to death. She's having a nightmare. She cannot control her speech. On the other hand, we've got a mother who has run out of words for the day. She can't do anything. She can hold her daughter's hand. She can hum something to her, but she can't soothe her. So she actually has to take a back seat and watch her husband and her sons do what they can to try and take care of this little six-year-old girl. And that was, I don't know whether that was as frightening as it was emotionally charged. I mean, there must be something really awful about being a mother and being powerless to help your child when he or she is in need.
Now, Jean, she had a bit of a rebellious streak in her, but that didn't come until later, because one of the other characters in the book was her college roommate, Jackie. And Jackie warned Jean when they were in college about complacency. What is your take on activism? I mean, do you participate in protests?
Do I participate in protests? You know, I can't say that I do. I'm not a marcher. On the other hand, I do vote. You know, I do think it's important to write to our congressmen. I also think it's important to speak up, even in the private sort of sphere, even in a domestic sphere or a cocktail party sort of a situation. And so in that respect, I'm actually very, very vocal. And there's a sense in which, and we all have our different strengths and our different weaknesses. I think some people are more predisposed to march on Washington and carry a sign. I think others are more predisposed to write an essay or a letter to the editor, or to try and engage people with differing opinions in a more intimate kind of a space. I'm probably that second kind of a person. I'm a little bit, I don't want to say insular, really, but I'm a little shy.
You know, even though we don't see Jackie as much as we do Jean in this novel, she still has an important message. What do you think she would want your readers to take away, you know, from her mind?
Sure. I mean, it's interesting that you say that about Jackie. She's really, for most of the book, she's a ghost, right? She's Jean's conscience. She's the antithesis of Jean, who's been a very, you know, passive kind of self-contained researcher who created a bubble for herself and lived in it. So obviously, I think Jackie's message, both to Jean in the book and both to anyone who's reading the book, is that it's absolutely vital we pay attention to what's going on around us and to what's going on in the political sphere. And it's quite interesting. I mean, I never like to go into lecture mode about who votes and who doesn't vote and who writes our congressmen and who doesn't. But I was astounded when I realized that voter turnout for presidential elections is somewhere between 60 and 65%. And for local elections, so much less than that. I was even more astounded when I went to Europe for some publicity tours this summer, and I found out from the Germans and the Italians and the English that the numbers are about the same. Now, obviously, voting is not the only way we can speak up, and there are often reasons to abstain from voting. But I think Jackie's message would be, we really do need to make sure that we don't insulate ourselves to such an extent that we let the world go by and assume that everything is going to roll along exactly as it's been rolling along, because things can change. I mean, we've seen that, obviously. We've seen it in recent history, very recent history. but we've seen it in not so recent history. We've seen revolutions in Cuba, in Hungary. You know, we've seen the rise of regimes in the Mideast, in Germany, and so forth. I mean, it can happen everywhere. Nobody is really safe from unexpected change.
Now, in the book, when this was going on in the U.S., the rest of the world was laughing at us. Do you think they laugh at us now?
Oh, I think a lot of people love to laugh at the U.S. And having lived abroad and traveled abroad for quite a bit of my life, I can certainly see this. I think we have to balance that out with the fact that lots of people still really want to come here. So sometimes you laugh at what you're uncomfortable with and whatnot. Do I think people are laughing at us now? I don't know. I can certainly see something a bit ridiculous in the way that we've allowed ourselves to become very polarized, much more so than I think we were when I was much younger, when there was very little difference, really, between a Democrat and a Republican. You know, we're talking about a little left of center, a little right of center, yeah? But I think that things are spreading out further, and there's more of a gap. And of course, when we start talking about merging religion and state, as we do in Vox, where we've got a very extreme religious right faction, it's not everyone, but there's an extremism there that has taken over, effectively bought the presidency by guaranteeing votes. I could certainly see that as something to snicker at.
It seems like when certain atrocities happen in the world, other countries do step in to help. And there was a resistance also in the United States. And, you know, before the resistance was revealed, you know, the reader had to think, where are the fathers of the daughters? Where are the husbands? Yet they were there, weren't they?
They were there. The fathers of the daughters were there. Even look at Patrick, the Jean's husband, the father of Sonia. He's certainly there. He is, and I imagine as most men in this situation are, he's not happy with the situation at all. But that doesn't mean that he's not going along with it. He's got to go along with it. He's got a job. They need his income. There are all kinds of ways, I think, where people can be trapped into going along or seemingly going along with a certain wave, even when they disagree with it.
Talk to me about your work in linguistics, because I was also looking at your website, and you know, this is your first novel, right? But you have written a lot of work out there. I mean, I couldn't get to the bottom of your page. It was you've written so much. Talk to me about maybe your work in linguistics, and then also how you balancing that with how much you write as well.
Sure. Well, I actually went into linguistics rather late in life. I didn't start graduate school until I was in my 30s, and it was a very, very abrupt shift for me from what I was doing before, which was accounting and bookkeeping and budgeting and whatnot. I actually worked for NPR in their budget department when I was, well, a while ago, let's say. So I did work in linguistics. I went ahead. I got my master's and my PhD. My specialty was in sound patterns and sound change. And it was not as long a career as I expected it to be, partly because of, various moves around the globe. But I do have this background. And when I started writing creatively as opposed to writing technically, which is what I had to do when I was working in academia, I realized that there were a lot of linguistic-y kinds of things that would sort of crop up, a lot of things that had to do with sound. Sometimes I would write very experimental flash fiction, so extremely short stories, using aspects of linguistics, using even linguistic technical terms, and actually creating kind of a narrative around them. So it's been great fun for me to write either short form or long form stories that introduce linguistics. And one of the nice things about it, too, is that I realized this when I was both studying and when I was teaching or, you know, working as a researcher in my field. So few people actually know about linguistics or know what it is. You know, I had to keep explaining, no, I'm not a translator. No, I don't speak five different languages fluently. No, I'm not a grammatical, you know, guru. I mean, I am, but I'm not going to sit there and, you know, lecture you on how to speak or whether you said a word incorrectly or spelled something incorrectly. I mean, linguistics is so much bigger than that. It's so much more about trying to describe this amazing system that we humans and only humans have, while at the same time coming up with a way to explain how such a complex system of words and rules can be acquired by a three-year-old. I mean, the complexity on the one hand, balanced with this ease of acquisition that's almost magical, on the other hand, really does boggle the mind. And that's really what linguists do. And I wanted to bring some of the ideas about how integral language is to our humanity, and also how important it is, crucial it is that language be learned by a certain time. Otherwise, we risk not having it at all. So I think if we projected into the future a few generations, if this regime in Vox were permitted to continue, and the Sonias, the little girls of this world, were generation by generation speaking less and less, acquiring a very deprived form of language, I could actually envision a time in which the word counters wouldn't be needed at all. The females in this society would have been reduced to sort of the role of a household pet who could cook and clean. That's a very long answer.
No, it's very thought-provoking. Have you tried to limit yourself to 100 words a day?
I've never done it on purpose, but I did have an experience when we first moved from London to Hertfordshire in the UK, and almost immediately after moving to this new town and this new house, my husband got a job in Abu Dhabi, and he was traveling 2 or 3 weeks out of the month, and I didn't know anyone. I remember it was winter, it was cold, it was drizzly, typical English winter weather. It's dark, of course. And I would sit in this, you know, my little cozy room, you know, knitting. And I'd realize at 5 o'clock, I hadn't actually spoken to anyone. And it was weird. I mean, you know, I'm a quiet person generally, but actually not speaking to people for that long a time. And of course, because of the time difference, yeah, I couldn't really call family and friends who were in the U.S. until much later in the day. So I felt very, very isolated. And I imagine I can't even put myself in the position, obviously, but what a mind trip it must be to, you know, to not be able to speak, to not be able to communicate at all, to find yourself in a situation where that right is taken away. You know, you can imagine people in solitary confinement. You can imagine prisoners of war who are held captive. And, you know, I mean, this is why I think the military teaches people how to communicate in tap codes and things like that. Tap codes meaning like a code where you, you know, tap out something like Morse, you could say, in order to maintain that communication, that human connection. It's crucial. It's really quite vital, I think, to our well-being.
What do you hope that readers will come away with? We've talked a little bit about what Jackie would want, but what do you want readers to take away from this book?
Sure. Well, there are two things, actually. One is this idea that we really do need to pay attention to what's going on around us in the world, in the political world. And we need to do this responsibly, of course, you know, paying attention. I mean, it doesn't mean reading a tweet and then forwarding it on to 1,000 people before you've actually read the article that's referenced in the tweet, right? I mean, there are all kinds of ways we can do this. We can, you know, have a look at executive orders. We can watch C-SPAN. You know, we can really try to, you know, read articles that are published. So I think paying attention is a huge message. And the other part of that is to really be on the lookout for extremism. And when I say extremism, I mean extremism in any form. I don't mean just to one side of the political spectrum, because extremism can happen in lots of different domains. So I do hope that that's a message that people can pick up on, you know, to not be so passive and to think about what we can do. Another part of it, though, is because linguistics, particularly with respect to language acquisition and the necessity that language needs to be acquired by a certain age, or else it may not be acquired at all, as we see in the stories of these very rare cases of feral children like Victor of Avignon or Jeannie, the wild child from Southern California in the early 70s. I do hope that people, after they read Vox, I mean, it's obviously it's a political thriller, but it's also a political thriller that has an element of linguistics in it. And I've actually been really delighted when some readers have come up to me at book signings and said, "Your book makes me want to take a linguistics course." That is absolutely fantastic. I mean, for a piece of commercial fiction to spur someone to kind of look harder at an academic subject that they've never heard of before. Wow. I mean, you know, what a fantastic thing that is.
That was Christina Dalcher, author of the political thriller Vox, which was published by Berkeley. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. You can discover more episodes at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torrin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.